The Tom Woods Show, episode 1990.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. Harry's, the official razor of the Tom Woods Show, is offering listeners their starter set at harrys.com/woods. That's a five-blade razor, a weighted ergonomic handle, foaming shave gel, and a travel blade cover, a $13 value, all for just $3 at harrys.com/woods. Hey, folks, Tom Woods here. We're going to be talking about the Nobel Prize in Economics today, and we're going to be talking about, frankly, one of the three winners in particular, and talking about the meaning of this, what this means for economics as a field. And we're going to be doing that with our old friend, Peter Klein, who's a professor of economics at Baylor University. And Peter, I know you have a million credentials. You have your PhD from University of California at Berkeley. But at Baylor University, what is your specific title? And are you teaching not just economics, but entrepreneurship? Are you in the business school? Give us the details.
Yeah, Tom, I am an economist by training, but at Baylor University, I am in the business school. We have a department of entrepreneurship and corporate innovation, and that's where I'm housed. We have a major in entrepreneurship. We have a minor. We have a graduate program. You can get a PhD in entrepreneurship. So we have a lot of economists in the department, but also people trained in psychology, sociology, and management as well.
Okay, great, great, great. You're one of the shining lights, honestly, of the Austrian school right now. It's not just your credentials, but your scholarly output, your articles, your books, the work you've done with Hayek is very, very impressive. And so you're one of the most significant academics we have.
Well, thank you. That's very kind, Tom. I appreciate it. And I do want to say I'm really honored to be on show 1990. I wish you would invite me, you know, for nine shows down the road so we could party like it's 1999.
Like it's 1999. Everybody's saying that to me. That's right. And, you know, the thing is that once you get to 1900, then every numerologist in the world wants you to talk about the significance of 1900X, and I'm just not doing it. There are so many things. I could have talked about the end of World War II in 1995. I could have talked about World War I. And I, because once I start that, then everybody expects it forever, and I refuse to do it. I'm going to do it on my own schedule and my own time.
It's a good
point. So first of all, let me point out, as you know, Peter, because we're recording this in the evening, I'm spending a few days in Savannah, Georgia, before I return back to Orlando for the 2000th episode of the Tom Woods Show, which I'm recording live as a big event in Orlando. And I've never been to Savannah before, and I absolutely love it. It's a beautiful place. But we just returned from a very, very good meal at a place called Noble Fare. We had the tasting menu with the wine pairing. And I'll just put it this way. There were probably seven or eight courses in this meal. It was unbelievable, fantastic, wonderful. But if there's a wine pairing, you realize there's wine every single time.
Of course.
So that means old Woods here is a little bit, let's just say, on the impaired side compared to other episodes he's done over the course of the years. So if Woods gets through this episode still appearing to be intelligent and informed and articulate, then I think anybody who is not currently contributing to the Tom Woods Show suddenly becomes obligated to do so because I have done the impossible. So if I do this and it's a great conversation, then you head over to supportinglisteners.com because you owe me. And actually, I don't even know why they owe me. I just made this up. But it just feels like if I do, I've never done this before. I feel like I deserve something. I don't know. I deserve something for this. All right.
Tom,
let's talk.
I am going to try my hardest to be a guest worthy of an impaired Tom Woods.
I have no idea what that means, but it sounds like it's going to be great. So we're talking specifically about David Card. And I actually don't know what his academic credentials are or what institution he's associated with. But I do know, and maybe you can fill us in on that, he's the person we're going to be talking about. What he is associated with is the famous Card-Kruger study from about 1994 involving the minimum wage. And what I want to talk to you about today is not so much the details of that particular study. Bob Murphy has actually done really good work on that. I mean, he really has scoured the literature on the minimum wage and on the critiques of the Card-Kruger study. And so I'll link to some of his material at tomwoods.com/1990. So, I mean, obviously, if you know some of that, I'm delighted to talk about that. But I really want to take this opportunity to talk more about maybe a big picture of what this means for economics as a discipline? Because I actually think the awarding of the prize to David Card is catastrophic for economics, but I'd love to hear your thoughts about it. But let's start off by talking about who is David Card, first of all.
Yeah, David Card is a very well-known labor economist, empirical labor economist. He got his PhD at Princeton. He taught at a number of universities. He was at Princeton, I believe, when he published this paper that became quite well-known with Alan Krueger that you mentioned. He's now at UC Berkeley as a distinguished professor and one of the leaders in this sort of new way of doing empirical microeconomics. I think your comment is quite insightful that he's relatively well-known for an academic economist, you know, to the general public, for having been the co-author of this famous Card and Krueger study, which got a lot of attention in the media and has been used, really misused, by people who want to make an argument either about the minimum wage or about how, you know, kind of conventional economics is broken because it assumes that markets work and so forth. That's a little bit unfair to Card himself, but he's really best known among economists for being one of the pioneers of this particular technique of doing empirical research. And that's really what the Nobel Prize Committee recognized, giving the prize to Card, but also to two econometricians who are not well known at all to the general public, but who specialize in sort of technical issues related to this particular approach, the so-called natural experiments approach to economics.
Now, that study has been, which concluded apparently, that increases in the minimum wage do not necessarily lead to increases in unemployment, has been touted over and over again over the past, what, I guess over 25 years now,
yeah,
by politicians who want to believe that this is the case. And there are many critiques that one could make of this, and many critiques have been made of that paper. And maybe the least significant of them is simply the fact that they're not talking about what's being discussed today, which is basically, frankly, a doubling of the minimum wage. The people who are talking about $15 an hour are talking in practice about, if not a doubling of the minimum wage, then something awfully close to that.
Yeah.
And that's not what Card and Krueger were talking about. So it's not clear that that would have no effect. But the thing is, there are reasons to believe, based on the basics of economic theory, that of course, if you increase the price of labor, less labor will be demanded. In the same way that if the price of steel, let's say, doubled all of a sudden, there would be some firms and some industries that would go looking for alternatives to steel, substitutes for steel, that may not be, you know, indistinguishable from steel from a scientific point of view, but in terms of fulfilling the needs that that business and that firm has, are essentially indistinguishable, and they would start using those. So we have no problem acknowledging that in the case of steel, that sure, if the price goes up, people will demand less. But for some reason, there's some weird superstition about labor, that if the price of labor goes up, nobody cares.
Yeah.
The business just goes on as before, employment goes on as before. And they apparently performed this study, and they said, well, look at what we found. But without pausing to say, but look, every bit of common sense the human race has says this can't possibly be right.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Tom. I mean, look, there are several different layers to unpack here. Some of the technical details of the study, they almost certainly got wrong. The data collection effort was very sloppy. They hired students to call fast food restaurants and ask them questions about how many people they employed. They really didn't ask the right questions. They didn't measure labor the right way. But I mean, that's sort of a minor point. I mean, the more general point, the one that you're hinting at, is look, most people, except for a few nerds like you and me, and probably a lot of your listeners, are not all that interested in economic theory. People only pay attention to economists when politicians, policymakers, journalists, and so forth. They pay attention to economists, just like they pay attention, I guess, to any scientists, only when it's sort of politically convenient to do so. So, of course, you have, you know, the whole sort of, you know, mainstream kind of left-leaning thinkers and thought leaders and journalists and policymakers and so forth. You know, they don't like markets, of course. They don't think that markets work very well. They think that markets are plagued with these so-called, you know, failures, that the steady and wise hand of government is needed to repair and to mediate. So, you know, the kind of standard economic analysis that says the government cannot force the economy to work in a different way than the way, you know, it works when people are voluntarily interacting, exchanging, and so forth. That just like you say, if you force the price to be above or below the price that would emerge on the free market, there are going to be consequences. There are going to be misallocations of resources, surpluses, shortages, and so forth. We all know that, right? And it's just as true in the labor market as it is in any market. But look, Tom, economists traditionally were not popular with politicians because economists, especially economists, you know, in the Misesian tradition, were always saying, look, there are these fundamental economic laws that you, the policymaker, you, the journalist, you, the philosophy professor, you can't just sort of wave a magic wand and make those laws go away any more than you can do that for the laws of gravity or, you know, principles of engineering, physics, and so forth. Of course, politicians don't like that because it's a way of telling them no. No, your stupid build back better or whatever you call it, whatever you want to call it, running the printing press a little bit faster, that is not going to, you know, have the effects that you promise people, that you promise your constituents, your readers, and so forth, it will have. Economists were always the ones saying, no, that won't work. No, that's going to have these, you know, negative consequences and so forth. So nobody liked economists. But when economists every once in a while say something that the media, the politicians, the philosophy professors like, of course, they sort of glom onto it and say, aha, you know, if you do economics correctly, it proves that, of course, the government can fix things. It proves that employers really are exploiting workers. They're paying the workers too little. If we force them to pay the workers more, the workers will just be better off, but there won't be any harmful consequences. Nobody will be unemployed or whatever. So the Card-Kruger paper, which was really a pretty minor contribution to a huge literature on labor markets and minimum wage, you know, was seized upon by all the pundits and policymakers. This was back in the Clinton administration. And, you know, the Clinton people, you know, they grabbed it and said, aha, this justifies a bunch of policies that we were going to enact anyway. Now we have some sort of scientific rigor or scientific backing for them. So it was a really an opportunistic use of this one particular study, which was really not that great a study to begin with.
Listening to you right now, Peter, reminds me of a Thomas Sowell book called A Conflict of Visions. Did you ever read that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So in that book, he talks about the constrained vision and the unconstrained vision.
Absolutely.
There are these two ways of looking at the world. And the constrained vision is one that views the human condition as fundamentally tragic, that although there is, you know, obviously much good in human life, we cannot accomplish all the things that we dream of because there are natural constraints upon our action. We can't just wish for things and they automatically come true. We can't pass a law that brings about the creation of wealth. The creation of wealth comes about through investment and hard work and entrepreneurial foresight. There's no law you can pass for this. That would be incredibly juvenile to think that. But there are people who believe in the so-called unconstrained vision who think that the only thing standing between us and utopia is wise planning and the will of the politicians to carry their program through, come what may. And that's just the opposite of the constrained vision, which believes that, which understands the problems with economic planning and with utopian schemes. So there are these two different visions that are at odds with each other. And I always, you know, up until somewhat recently, I always associated economics, not just Austrian economics, but economics as a field, as being part of the constrained vision, as being people who say to the powers that be, you cannot accomplish this. Now, maybe the powers that be ignore them, but they're there to say there are limits to what the human will alone can accomplish. And there are economic laws that stand in defiance of your political desires. And I feel like in recent years, but particularly with the awarding of the Nobel Prize in part to David Card, this is a strike at the heart of economics in the sense that it makes economics no longer part of that constrained vision, but rather it makes it part of that vision of, well, if we wish hard enough, we can get whatever we want. Now, maybe I'm exaggerating, but do you understand what I'm driving at?
I do, and I think you're onto something. I think your application of the Sowell framework there is quite apt in this case. But, you know, Tom, one thing you and I have talked about a few other times on the show, I've written about a little bit, is how the economics profession over the last 10 to 20 years really has changed quite a lot, even within kind of the mainstream of the profession. There's been a de-emphasis on theory, on this idea that economics does provide us with these sort of general laws. I mean, most economists who are not disciples of the Austrian school of Ludwig von Mises would not put it quite as strongly as we would, that there are these sort of immutable, you know, relationships and laws of economics that even, you know, the typical mainstream economists believed, yeah, demand curves slope down. If the government mandates a price that's higher than the market clearing price, that's going to have some consequences. How do you know that? Well, you know, we can derive that from a few basic principles, just sort of thinking through the problem. What is now often derided, especially by people who have been commenting and celebrating the Nobel Prize announced, they call this, you know, so-called blackboard economics, or Paul Krugman calls it, you know, 101-ism. He means like Econ 101 is like sort of the intro basic principles of economics course, which of course was the heart of the discipline, has been for decades, if not centuries, now is sort of denigrated as too primitive, not sufficiently sophisticated, too theoretical, not empirical. What the contemporary approach in economics, and by contemporary, I mean, as I say, last 10, 20 years, what that approach holds is that, no, there really aren't any economic laws. There really aren't any basic principles. There's very little that we can say about an economic problem merely by thinking it through logically and consistently, applying the sorts of theories or models, if you like, that we've been, you know, using for generations. Rather, we have to start with a blank slate and do this completely kind of atheoretical, experimental, empirical approach. You know, all we want to know is if the government, you know, the government increases the corporate tax rate, what impact is that going to have on business behavior? So an Austrian economist, or really even a neoclassical economist prior to a couple of decades ago, would say, look, I mean, if you increase the corporate tax rate, that is going to reduce the incentives of companies to make the investments and engage in the activities that generate profit, because a larger share of that corporate income will be going to the state, a smaller share will be retained by the firm to be paid out in dividends, capital gains to be reinvested, and so forth. And of course, you could work through that analysis in as much detail as you want. But there's kind of a basic insight that a little bit of economic theory gives you. And that little bit of economic theory traditionally has gone a long way. Now, what the economists, the mainstream economists, say is, what will be the impact of an increase in the corporate tax rate on, say, you know, R&D or investment? We have absolutely no idea. All we can do is perform a randomized controlled trial or look for an opportunity to engage in a natural experiment, and we will measure the impact of that variable X, the change in the corporate tax rate, on some outcome variable of interest Y. We don't have any prior theory or analysis or you know, beliefs that we bring to the table. We're just engaged in a completely atheoretical measurement exercise. And that's, I'm slightly exaggerating, but that's kind of what the new trend in empirical economics is. And I find it very troublesome.
What does this mean for economics as a whole? Is this where the discipline seems to be going? Are there people who are standing up against it?
Yeah. I mean, so there are a few who are pushing back a little bit. I mean, what most sensible economists, mainstream economists, as well as Austrians say is, look, you know, if one is going to do empirical analysis, what we Austrians would call, you know, historical analysis, looking at prices and other phenomena of the immediate past, there are a variety of approaches, techniques, methods that we can use. We can collect quantitative data. We can use them the way Rothbard did in America's Great Depression, the way great historians like Robert Higgs have done. We can collect data. We can do some statistical analysis of trends. We can also do interviews. We can do in-depth case studies. We can apply a variety of methods of historical or empirical analysis. Each one, you know, provides some insight, but has some potential weaknesses. And we sort of assess the entire body of evidence using our judgment as scholars to try to tease out what we think is really going on. Now you have this view that, no, the only thing that is valid is these natural experiments or randomized controlled trials. That's what the Nobel Prize 2 years ago went to, the people who do these so-called RCTs in developing countries. Some economists have said, no, come on, you know, that's one way to do it, but that's not the only way. But I think there's a lot of momentum behind this sort of newer approach. And Tom, one thing that is related to this, and sort of hinted at, I think, maybe by what I was saying before, the kinds of economic questions that are being asked are really not even economic questions. It's almost like economics is just a branch of applied statistics. For example, a lot of this literature in another area that the three economists who won the Nobel Prize this week have worked in and were credited for, is, you know, finding clever ways to analyze the additional earnings that people get over their professional, over their working lives from having more education, right? So they develop these clever techniques for figuring out whether a little bit of extra schooling generates a little bit of extra income on average. And, you know, it's sort of an interesting literature. But at the end of the day, the research question they're asking is, if you have more education, can you get a better job? I mean, there's really not any economic analysis in that, right? To put it another way, you don't need to have a PhD in economics. In fact, you don't need to have ever taken an economics course of any kind or listened to a single episode of the Tom Woods Show to be able to run that experiment. You just have to be somebody who knows how to collect data on years of education, to collect data on, you know, earnings over a person's career. You run it through the computer. I mean, there's really no economics in it at all. It's just kind of a, you know, it's just sort of isolated, potentially interesting empirical question. It's not really connected to any other theoretical or empirical issues. It doesn't involve any kind of analysis of human behavior, or incentives, or how we approach trade-offs. Again, there's really not any economics in it. It's just kind of applied statistics.
Hey, folks, just going to interrupt this episode to tell you a quick story. And this story involves the official razor of the Tom Woods Show, Harry's. I was coming upon October 2nd, 2021. It was the day of the Take Human Action Tour event sponsored by the Mises Caucus of the Libertarian Party. And I was supposed to give the keynote address. And I did not have my Harry's razor with me. So I thought, all right, well, I got to get another Harry's razor and I got to get the Harry's shave gel. I don't shave any other way. Can't do it. Won't do it. So I went to a drugstore that, believe it or not, there's such a drugstore that did not have any Harry's products at all. So I could have gotten all kinds of competitor products, but I actually said, I'm not doing it. I'm leaving this place and I'm going to go find another place that has Harry's. And that's what I did. I got my Harry's razor and the shave gel. The two things combined give you an outstanding result. Smooth, comfortable, close shave every single time. And not to mention, you can get a great shave with Harry's without breaking the bank. Refill blades start as low as $2. Harry's offers a whole range of amazing face and body care products for men. Remember, I mentioned that shave gel. You got to use it. It's so smooth and beautiful, delivered right to your door. There's never been a better time to try Harry's. Go to harrys.com/woods to get their starter set for just $3. It's 100% satisfaction guaranteed, so you've got nothing to lose. Go to harrys.com/woods right now to get this special offer. That's harrys.com/woods. Well, let's suppose there was a case where we were observing the price of lumber, let's say, and for whatever reason, the price of lumber went up by 3 times. And as soon as it went up by 3 times, the quantity demanded of lumber just skyrocketed. We wouldn't say, well, I guess people want more lumber the more expensive it is.
Yeah, that's right.
We would not say that.
We would not.
We would look at it and say that there must be multiple things going on simultaneously that then complicate the ultimate result. We're going to have to tease out what these multiple things were.
Right.
So in other words, you have to have, you cannot just look at a bunch of numbers, abstract it from reality. Just look at a bunch of numbers and say, well, the numbers tell the story. The numbers absolutely, resolutely do not tell the story unless there is some theoretical framework in which we can place them. Any more so than you could do history by just recording a bunch of facts. If you were a historian and all you did was record quote-unquote facts, you'd be recording every single breakfast George Washington ever had. Every single breakfast. And you'd record every step he took with his feet and whatever. Unless you had some theoretical background, you wouldn't know what was even worth recording. What affects what the cause and effect relationships are. And it seems like, unfortunately, this is the direction economics is going, where economics has to, you would think it has to be at its root theoretical.
Yeah.
And then when you look at empirical examples, you apply the theory to the empirical examples in order to understand the empirical examples. The numbers alone don't tell you anything.
You know, I hate to bring the discussion back to COVID because we're all sick of talking about it, but you can see the parallel, right? So people who don't really understand how medical science works, they don't really understand epidemiology, they don't understand science at all, are the people who are, you know, asserting the most bold, with the most boldness and confidence and obnoxiousness, right, on social media or whatever. You know, the science has spoken, you know, mask up everybody, or the science has spoken, you know, Governor DeSantis of Florida has killed this many thousands of people. I mean, I think we all know that people who speak that way are obviously speaking out of ignorance and malice and so forth as well. But you can sort of cherry pick numbers to sort of justify whatever kind of ridiculous COVID claims you want to make. But one of the points that many of us, you're of course a great example, people who have been thoughtful analysts and critics of the, you know, sort of Fauci approach over the last 18 months has been, no, you know, you really have to be more careful in what data you look at and how you interpret those data, how you frame the problem. It's simply not the case that the numbers speak for themselves on a complex social, medical, economic issue. So just as in looking at anything to do with so-called public health, right, it takes skilled and judicious and thoughtful interpretation to make sense of the numbers. Exactly the same is true for economists. Exactly the same is true for historians, really for any, you know, any social scientist, any political analyst who's trying to make sense of the world around them. But, you know, maybe this is an extension, Tom, of something that's been going on over more than 100 years, right? As mainstream economics went more in the direction of trying to imitate the hard sciences. Right, it's this idea that the more we copy what our friends in physics or chemistry do, the more sort of scientific we are. And economics was always kind of in the middle, right? Mainstream economics, certainly since, you know, say World War II, has been dominated by mathematical formalism on the theory side and quantitative econometric analysis on the empirical side. But it was always kind of a blend. I mean, there was still some basic theory. Most economists had some intuition about what the answer would be. Right. And they brought that theoretical background, that interpretive frame to the analysis at hand. Even that, you know, seems to be going by the wayside, that the trend really now is all on, you know, again, trying to copy what, you know, so-called real scientists do in the laboratory. I've made the joke, Tom, because, you know, I follow economic discussions on social media and so forth, that, you know, in my day, of course, we didn't have social media back then, but if we did, right, we would be arguing about things like, you know, Keynesianism versus Austrianism, or, you know, what causes the business cycle? Can the government really stimulate economic growth? Those are the kinds of things we argued about, you know, in the student lounge, and what we would have argued about on Twitter if we'd had Twitter back in the day. You know what PhD students in economics argue about now? The one issue about which most of them are the most passionate, it's coding. Right? Which software package should you use to write your code and to run your analysis? That's the only thing that people care about. You have these really impassioned debates and arguments about which statistics package is better. I mean, come on. Is that why you get a PhD in economics? So that you can be a coder?
Yeah.
You can make a lot more money coding, you know, in the business world if you're any good at it.
Well, I don't remember the exact quotation, but Ludwig von Mises said somewhere, and maybe more than once, something along the lines of something like this, that politicians can't stand economists. Now, of course, he means real economists. He means the economists of his day and in his tradition, because they are skeptics of what mere political will can accomplish. Every State of the Union speech has messianic overtones. You know, the political world can solve your problems and can bring you salvation. And right. The economists are the ones who are supposed to be there saying, no, you cannot accomplish that by political will. You can't wish these things into existence. You can't wish capital formation into existence. There are constraints and there are trade-offs. And that's what economists are constantly supposed to be reminding people of. There are constraints and trade-offs. You can say that we can accomplish this by passing a law. And yeah, it's true. If you pass some law, maybe there will be a handful of people who earn a higher income as a result of that. I mean, you know, with coercion, you know, with brute force, I mean, presumably you can accomplish something. But at the same time, there'll be other results. There'll be people who lose their jobs, who never get hired in the first place. This is how a non-juvenile person looks at the world, that you can't just will what you desire into existence. You have to recognize there are trade-offs and there are constraints. And it seems to me, as somebody not in the field of economics, that economics is moving away from being outside the regime as critics, as people issuing warnings, and rather as people who desperately desire recognition and respect within the regime, and therefore telling the politicos, yes, you can accomplish this. As long as you follow my model and you use this equation, you can get what you wish, and your wishes can be made reality. Exactly the opposite of what economists used to do.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think a lot of economists today view their role as kind of engineers, you know, in service of the state, right? You know, my goal is to help the policymakers, help them design their interventions, is the word that's used today. Economics, they would say, is about, you know, helping design interventions that correct market failures. That's what a lot of young people, sad to say, understand economics to be. And yeah, it's a problem. I mean, you know, to end on a happier note, as I said, I do think that, you know, the pendulum kind of swings back and forth. I think that probably people are starting to recognize a little bit, and will recognize increasingly so in the coming years, that this sort of trendy new stuff is, you know, has been sort of oversold. Again, to use the analogy to make the comparison with 2 years ago, the people who won 2 years ago were also atheoretical empiricists who do so-called field experiments. You know, you go into some village in Bangladesh and you split the village into two and you give these people a red pill and the other people a blue pill and you see what, you know, what happens to, you know, economic outcomes or whatever. That was super, super trendy and fashionable. But even that, I see more criticism now of that kind of approach. Well, you know, it has a lot of drawbacks. It can't really be used to answer certain kinds of problems. And the results aren't really reliable. You can't generalize from one village to the next or to other contexts. I suspect that the same will happen with the current emphasis on so-called natural experiments. That, yeah, I mean, they're clever and they can be used to, you know, address certain kinds of issues, but they're not sort of the panacea. It's not the be-all and end-all of what economic analysis should be all about. I just hope that there are enough younger scholars coming along who are interested in theory and who really will cling to that traditional role of the economist, the way you articulated it very well, as someone who explains to politicians, among others, that no, you can't, you know, you can't just wish these things into existence any more than you could wish, you know, an airplane to fly up in the sky. Gravity works against you. And we want people to say supply and demand works against you, right? You know, incentives and opportunity costs work against you. They won't allow you to do that thing that you want to do. Again, the trend is worrisome, but I'm hopeful that eventually people will come around and we'll go back to something that is a little bit of a more reasonable approach.
Well, of course, for younger people listening to this, the key is to attend the Mises University program, which I attended as early as 1993, and it will ground you in real economics. And not to mention, for that entire week that you're at the Mises Institute, and of course, I'm talking about Mises University, M-I-S-E-S University, get the details at Mises.org/events. You'll have a great time getting to know the faculty, the other students. But honestly, for me, I can say that as a college student, it was by far the best academic experience I had ever had. And I went to an elite university as an undergraduate, but by far the best intellectual experience I ever had was at Mises University. And it's training people to think in the way that we've been describing here. And, you know, we hope will help to repair some of the damage done by some of the economists we have to endure these days. So Mises.org/events is where to go. If you are a young person, or you are the parent of a young person, or you know a young person, and particularly a college student, then you should apply for that event and attend it. And you will learn an enormous amount and be, as I say, very, very well grounded in truly sound economics. Well, Peter, I appreciate you coming on. And I would say I handled this pretty well, considering I'm a guy who just endured, maybe an 8-course meal with a consistent wine pairing throughout for every one of those courses. I would say, if anything, I've sounded more intelligent than I have in the last 1,000 episodes of The Tom Woods Show.
You know, I was thinking the same thing. You're surprisingly eloquent tonight. I don't know if maybe those wine pairings would be a good idea before every show, but you should look into that.
Peter, you know what I think it is? I think it's overcompensation, because I feel like, oh my gosh, I better not sound like a stupid idiot who's drunk. I better be super articulate and attentive and whatever. But I feel like you can do that for only so many drinks. And once you get past a certain number of drinks, if you were to chart it, the numbers would come way down in terms of your ability to accomplish what I did on episode 1990 here of the Tom Woods Show. Now, what you did, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you coming on and sharing your expertise with us, but I have to say, I'm particularly impressed with what I did. I, Tom Woods, the host of the show, after this unbelievable meal, you know, you got to give me a round of applause or something. So the deal was, now I never officially made this deal with any single person listening to the show. However, the deal I made unilaterally was, if I come through this episode having impressed you intellectually, then you have to go to supportinglisteners.com and support the Tom Woods Show. So go do that. But also, while you're thinking about that, support the Mises Institute, which is supporting really sound economics of the kind that the United States and the world truly needs to hear about and learn. So MISES, Mises.org, is your other important mission here. Peter, of course, is a senior fellow of the Mises Institute, and he and I believe deeply in the mission of the Mises Institute, so I hope you'll support them. Peter, thanks so much for being with me today. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Tom. It's been fun. Look forward to talking to you the next time.
All right, everybody, that's going to do it for today. Hope to see you this Saturday, October 16th, 2021. It's just about here, the 2000th episode of The Tom Woods Show. You know you want to be there. You know those of you within driving distance at this point are thinking, well, I could maybe hop in the car and get there. I don't know if you want to make airline reservations at such with such little notice, but you could always do that. But you're not going to say, boy, I'm sorry I did this. I'll just leave it at that. You are not going to say, I'm sorry I did this. It's going to be something you'll remember for a long time. So check it out. Get the details. It's all laid out at tomwoods2000.com. Remember, this is not taking place at the same venue where we had the 1000th episode event. That was the Rosen Center in Orlando. This is the Rosen Shingle Creek. It's the same guy who owns both properties, but it's a completely different property. So make sure you pay attention to the details at tomwoods2000.com. Get there early. We're opening the doors at 7, starting promptly at 8. But get there early, and you can always meet people and chit-chat with your friends for a while, but get there early and get yourself a seat. All right, tomwoods2000.com is the website. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of The Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.